Way News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Probably this is not the end of the transition, but this is a big setback. Next, we have no idea.
That was Tunis University Professor Hamadi Redisi, who says passage of the country's new constitution threatens its fledgling democracy. Details coming up. Also, Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov heads to Ethiopia, the last stop of his four-nation tour of Africa. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Uganda and Russia have agreed to continue cooperation in trade and nuclear energy as Moscow seeks new partnerships and areas of cooperation in Africa. The announcement came during a visit today to Uganda by Russian Foreign Affairs Minister Sergei Lavrov. His trip comes amid an ongoing and highly criticized Russian attack on Ukraine, which has disrupted grain shipments to Africa. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
During a meeting with Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni in Kampala, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said his country is seeking new partnerships, especially with African countries.
Говорили сегодня также о первопричинах нынешних кризисов в сфере энергетики, в сфере снабжения мировых рынков продовольствием.
We have also discussed the current situation on the energy market and food provision. And our African friends understand that the current situation has nothing to do with the special military operation in Ukraine. And we agree that in our bilateral relations we are going to be underpinned by this principle, and we're going to search for new areas, for new ways of cooperation in the energy and in food market.
Russia has also promised to set up a laboratory in Uganda for the study and prevention of infectious diseases in Africa. Museveni is urging Russia to take an interest in Uganda's agriculture sector and improve its importation of agriculture products from Uganda.
There's nothing agricultural in the world that we cannot produce here. So if you need anything agricultural, coffee, we've got a lot of coffee. We're the biggest producers of coffee in the whole of Africa. Tea, milk, beef, grain, bananas. We're the second biggest producers of bananas in the whole world. And some of our products go to Russia through Western Europe. But we can now deal directly with you.
According to Museveni, Uganda will continue to strengthen bilateral relations with Russia, especially in areas of trade, security and nuclear energy, and called for stability in Russia to guarantee smooth trade.
We want trade with Russia, want trade with all countries of the world. We don't believe in being enemies of somebody's enemy. We want to make our own enemies, not fight other people's enemies. So when there is progress and stability in Russia, we also benefit because they buy some things from us, we buy things from them. Here we are going to cooperate in specific ways also, in space and atomic energy and so on. This is what we are looking for, win-win for everybody in the world. And it's possible.
Uganda is Lavrov's third stop on his tour of African countries. He was earlier in Egypt and Congo-Brazzaville. From Uganda, he now heads to Ethiopia. Analysts say Moscow is seeking to create ties with African countries following isolation and sanctions imposed on it by the West in retaliation for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
From Uganda, Lavrov headed to Ethiopia, the last stop on his four-nation tour of Africa, aimed at countering Western criticism of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Western nations blamed the invasion for worsening food shortages in record drought-stricken East Africa, including Ethiopia. But Ethiopia has also been under Western pressure over its war with Tigray rebels and has a historic friendship with Russia. Fred Harter reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov will round off his Africa tour by meeting Ethiopian officials in Addis Ababa as he fends off accusations that his country is exporting hunger through its war in Ukraine. He will also try and strengthen ties with Ethiopia's federal government, whose relationships with the West has soured amid accusations of human rights abuses in the Tigray conflicts. Russia's presence in Ethiopia is scant compared to other countries. It does not have a large aid footprint like the US, nor does it invest heavily in infrastructure as the Chinese do. But the two countries have a strong diplomatic partnership. Since the Tigray War started in November 2020, Russia has shielded Ethiopia at the United Nations Security Council by insisting meetings be held behind closed doors and using its veto to block statements condemning alleged abuses by Ethiopian forces. It is not unusual to hear people in Addis Ababa express a preference for Russia over Western countries, which Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government has suggested are behind a conspiracy supporting the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. Morgus Sodu Tashomi, an independent researcher, says the Russia-Ethiopia relationship has deep historical roots.
The Ethiopian government has always been in a good relationship, even during those turbulent periods of the Cold War, of course, siding with the Soviet Union, as you may recall. And then, if we see it in the context of the current quagmire which Ethiopia is in when it comes to its international relations and foreign policy posture, Russia has been backing the Ethiopian claims and or at least positions in the UN Security Council.
Ethiopian officials will likely seek assurances from Lavrov that Black Sea wheat exports will resume. Ethiopia has plans to boost its wheat production in an attempt to become self-sufficient. But for the time being, it imports over 40% of its grain from Ukraine and Russia. And some 30 million Ethiopians currently rely on food aid, much of which is sourced from global grain markets. Last year, as the Tigray War continued, Russia signed a security partnership with Ethiopia. The deal raised eyebrows among Western diplomats whose country suspended aid. However, Awet Weldy Michael, a professor at Queen's University in Ontario, says Russia cannot displace the presence of the West in Ethiopia, especially as the Prime Minister tries to rehabilitate ties with the US, now the conflict in Tigray is cooling down.
I don't think that the West's relationship with the Ethiopian Prime Minister is as bad as it was 6 months ago or a year ago. We increasingly see the West has been actively normalizing Prime Minister and his policies. In light of that, in light of the mending offenses, so to speak, between Addis Ababa and Western capitals, I doubt that Foreign Minister Lavrov will have much of a chance.
Ethiopia abstained from voting on the UN resolution condemning Russia's invasion of Ukraine in March. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The UN Commission tasked with investigating human rights violations committed during the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region began its first visit to the country yesterday. The UN Human Rights Council created the commission last December. Ethiopia had originally rejected it, calling it counterproductive before eventually approving its arrival. Fighting between the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, and Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government broke out in November 2020 and spread to the neighboring Afar and Amhara regions, with all sides accused of abuses. A joint investigation by the United Nations and Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission concluded in 2021 that crimes against humanity were potentially committed by all actors, according to a UN statement. The commission, made up of three experts from Kenya, Sri Lanka, and the United States, will remain in Ethiopia until July 30th, when it will release a statement. The Tigrayan authorities have said they are willing to cooperate with the commission, but have accused the federal government of wanting to dictate the terms of the investigation and compromising its credibility. Tunisian President Kais Saied and his supporters are celebrating the apparent adoption of his controversial new constitution following a referendum yesterday. But turnout for the vote was low and the opposition is disputing the results. Lisa Bryant reports from Tunis.
Tunisian President Kais Saied promised a new phase for his country as he met cheering supporters. He called the results of Monday's referendum an historic moment that offered lessons for the world. But President Saied's political opponents, who called on supporters to boycott the vote, see things differently. Samira Shawashi, president of the Heart of Tunisia party and vice president of Tunisia's now dissolved parliament, questioned the turnout and numbers presented by Syed's appointed election commission. She said the opposition would do its own check. Either way, she said, the low voter turnout, whether out of opposition or indifference, stripped the draft charter of legitimacy. President Syed says his new constitution, designed to create a strong presidency, dilute legislative powers, and establish a new regional assembly, will end the political gridlock that has gripped Tunisia for years. The opposition fears it will consolidate his one-man rule that began a year ago when Syed seized far-reaching powers, dissolving government and firing dozens of judges. Tunis University professor Hamadi Radisi says the outcome threatens the country's fledgling democracy.
Probably this is not the end of the transition, but this is a big setback. Next, we have no idea.
Il est un bon président.
But voters like furniture salesman Adel Zine are happy with the results. Still, he believes President Syed can't rule on his own. He lacks experience. If he becomes a dictator, Zine adds, voters will kick him out. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Tunis.
At least five people are reported dead and dozens of others wounded during the second day of protests against the United Nations peacekeeping force known as MONUSCO in Goma, in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Protesters attacked a warehouse of the MONUSCO force yesterday, demanding the peacekeepers leave after not protecting civilians for years in an area that's been plagued by militia violence. Reporter Jafar Al-Kitanti in Goma tells VOA's Carol Van Dam he is still hearing gunshots outside his house.
We saw about four people, one UN base, and Goma have five UN bases where people are protesting, and we are hearing about people in jails and being killed in all those zones. Even here at home, in my place, which is 500 meters from a UN base, even now when talking, I'm listening some gunshots. So it can be more than five people who were killed.
I understand that the protesters attacked a warehouse of the MONUSCO force. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. Things started last week on Friday, when a group of women protesting and went to the chief of bureau of MONUSCO, North Kivu. They wanted him to meet them and to hear from them that they don't want MONUSCO in the country, as MONUSCO said he's not strong to stop the advance of rebels like M23 and CODECO. So as they are not strong to fight against those rebels, they have to return back. But unfortunately, the boss of MONUSCO in North Kivu didn't meet those ladies, and they promised to do many strikes and protests in the week. And the protest is just against MONUSCO. People want MONUSCO to leave because for 22 years now, they do nothing according to what people are saying.
So you're saying that the protesters are upset because they've been there, you're saying, for 22 years, and in all that time they have not been able to protect citizens in that region that's been plagued by decades of violence from militia groups?
Now, very 2 years ago, the vice governor of North Kivu province came from Beni, where he was, and he talked to protesters at the biggest UN base in North Kivu. He told them that what you want, everybody know, as you don't want MONUSCO in the country, but now return back home, let the government decide to the future. But people answered in front of him, we will not leave here before the last UN agent leave.
I understand that the protest was called by a faction of the youth wing of the president's UDPS ruling party, but now it sounds like you're saying more and more people are getting involved in these protests. Is that right?
Yes, because yesterday it was around 200 or 500, but today there are tens of thousands of people in the streets, and they are blocking the wall and the main gate of Monisco base, which is very strong, but I saw people destroying it with just hands. So people are more and more angry. From yesterday, there were some people who were shot dead, and that was another motivation of protesters.
Well, what are the UN peacekeepers there doing in response at the base that's not far from where you are?
Where I was all this day, UN peacekeepers are in their base, and they shoot sometimes the blank bullets and sometimes the real bullets, and sometimes they shoot tear gas.
That was reporter Jafar Al-Khattati in Goma, DRC. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam earlier today. To Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America, I'm Yehiye Suwuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has announced what he calls an energy action plan to ease his country's intensifying electricity blackouts. In a live TV address, he promised to deregulate the energy sector and end bureaucracy, slowing down independent power producers. Ramaphosa also pledged to speed up wind, solar, and gas projects. South Africa suffered blackouts since 2008 when its old coal-driven power stations began failing. The crisis has been worsened by corruption and mismanagement at state energy company Eskom. Darren Taylor reports.
A major part of the plan involves pumping tens of billions of dollars into Eskom, a move critics describe as flogging a dead horse. As they say, the corporation's coal-based model is obsolete. But many energy experts say Ramaphosa has no choice but to prop up Eskom. That's because alternative sources of electricity won't realistically fulfill the energy needs of Africa's most industrialized economy for years. The president promised to fix Eskom's 15 power stations to achieve energy security and end blackouts.
The maintenance program of Eskom's electricity generation fleet has declined. Over the next 12 months, Eskom will increase the budget allocated for critical maintenance to increase the reliability of its generation capacity. We're cutting red tape that has made it difficult for Eskom to buy maintenance spares and equipment within the required period to effect repairs.
Ramaphosa acknowledged the performance of power plants has been poor, largely due to a shortage of expertise.
The utility is now recruiting skilled personnel, including former senior Eskom plant managers and engineers from the private sector. Some of these had left Eskom and had gone to various locales in the world, and Eskom is now seeking to bring them back. Now, these skilled personnel will help to ensure that world-class operating and maintenance procedures are reinstated.
Eskom retrenched thousands of white workers in the 1990s and 2000s as part of the ruling African National Congress's policy of black economic empowerment. Some of these white engineers and electricity systems experts have since helped solve energy crises in countries such as Vietnam and the Philippines. But the looming return of white experts to Eskom has angered some trade unions. They describe it as a slap in the face of black South Africans and a stunning insult to the skill of Eskom's many excellent black technical staff. Ramaphosa also announced the company would add more capacity to its grid by immediately buying surplus electricity from private power producers, including mines, factories and shopping malls, and further afield.
A number of our neighboring countries in Southern Africa, such as Botswana and Zambia, have more electricity capacity than they require for their economies. Eskom will now import power from these countries through the Southern African Power Pool arrangement.
He said Eskom would also use mobile generators, again at a high cost, given the price of diesel. He acknowledged Eskom remains in big trouble, especially because of a debt of 400 billion rands. That's about $25 billion. But, said Ramaphosa, he's confident the corporation's making changes to end the electricity crisis.
Eskom will be constructing its first solar and battery storage projects at several other power stations. This will result in over 500 megawatts being added to the grid.
He told citizens he's appointed a special law enforcement team to crack organized crime syndicates operating within Eskom. Ramaphosa said several officials had been arrested in recent weeks and charged with corruption and fraud related to coal and other contracts. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A father who wanted to sell his three albino children for use in witchcraft rituals was arrested in Mozambique before he could close the deal. Police in the northwestern region of Teti said yesterday three children, ages 9 to 16, were rescued over the weekend after an anonymous tip-off. Their uncle was arrested alongside their father. Local police spokesman Feliciano Di Camara told the French news agency AFP that the pair allegedly planned to traffic the minors to neighboring Malawi, where they could be sold for the equivalent of about $40,000. Both men deny any involvement in the case. Albinism, caused by a lack of melanin, the pigment that colors skin, hair, and eyes, is a genetic anomaly that affects hundreds of thousands of people across the globe. Some sub-Saharan African countries have suffered a wave of assaults against albinos whose body parts are sought for witchcraft practices in the belief there that they bring luck and wealth. 13 scrap metal collectors in northeast Nigeria's Borno state were killed when a bomb they dug exploded. Security sources told the French news agency AFP that 16 metal scavengers from a displaced persons camp in Bama found the bomb while digging for scrap yesterday in the bush on the outskirts of town. The bomb exploded as they were pushing it in a cart towards the town, killing 13 and seriously injuring 3. The ordinance, according to security sources, had apparently been dropped in 2015 when the military bombed Boko Haram positions during operations to retake Bama from the Islamic extremists. Most of the displaced who live in camps rely on food handouts from aid agencies, forcing many to turn to felling trees in the arid region for firewood and scavenging for metal scraps, which they sell to buy food. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.